Lucis Trust, a non-profit, non-political, and non-sectarian organization on the roster of the Economic and Social Council of the United Nations and concerned with the establishment of world cooperation and goodwill, presents Inner Sight with your host, Robert Anderson. He, with Sarah and Dale McKechnie, President and Vice President of Lucis Trust, will discuss philosophical and spiritual topics essential to everyday life. Now here's your host, Robert Anderson.
Welcome. Inner sight is simply seeing that which is always present, but not yet fully recognized. You have, within you, the ability to see yourself and the world around you in a new way with new eyes. So stay with us, and together we'll look at the world and ourselves with inner sight. Our topic for today, Discipleship of Alice A. Bailey. And before we explore this topic, I'd like to say a few words about Alice Bailey. Alice Bailey is the founder of Lucis Trust, and Lucis Trust sponsors this show. Alice Bailey also wrote 24 volumes of literature, and those 24 volumes of literature are the main inspiration for the dialogue that you hear on this show. Now, the following thought is also from Alice Bailey. A friend of mine felt that I would really render a service if I could show people how I became what I am from what I was. It might be useful to know how a rabid Christian worker could become a well-known esoteric teacher. People might learn much by discovering how a theologically minded Bible student could come to the firm conviction that the teachings of the East and of the West must be fused and blended before the true and universal religion for which the world waits could appear on earth. And once again, that's a quote from the literature of Alice Bailey. This suggests that Alice Bailey came from a rather narrow conservative religious background. Is that true?
Is it ever?
Hard to believe.
Yes, I know, considering where she ended up as one of the major writers of the Ageless Wisdom, which, as her thought that you opened with implies, shows or demonstrates the underlying truth that is common ground to both the religions of the East and the West. But as a young woman growing up in Britain in Victorian times, she was very much, as she says, a rabid Christian worker. She was born in 1880 to a socially prominent, highly placed family, but she was orphaned at a very early age. Both of her parents died when she was very young, and her life with her sister was spent shifting between various members of the extended family. And there's an autobiography that she wrote that is fascinating to read because it traces the development of this young Victorian upper-class British Christian girl and how her life circumstances led her to the point of becoming a well-known teacher of the Ageless Wisdom and the founder of a school that still functions today. So her life story, which in many ways I think she didn't want to write because she was a shy person, and the teaching that she wrote, the principles that her work is based upon, emphasize impersonality, unselfishness, focus on the one humanity, not on glorifying the individual by any means. But she thought that by sharing her story, other people would get hope from it, because she overcame so many limitations and broke her way through crystallized religious assumptions into a really direct experience of the spiritual life.
Yes, and she made it. That was a tremendous leap there. It was a 180-degree turn from what she was in her earlier life, and that's what's so amazing. She was this, as she said in that opening quote, and that's from her own autobiography, this rabid Christian worker. She was a real fundamentalist evangelical teacher and lecturer and counselor. She counseled the British Army troops. And so in her younger days, she was quite the very much out to save souls.
Yes.
And if you didn't believe in the way that you should believe, being a good Christian, then you were all going to hell. And, so she was...
It's really fundamental.
It really was. And she it's amazing how she went from that to what she ended up in her later life.
She tells in the early part of her autobiography about how her deep religious faith, and it was a really sincere, deeply felt Christian faith that stayed with her all her life. She always felt a particular closeness to the Christ, but she expanded that identification with Christ in her later years to include a deep appreciation for Hindu philosophy, for Buddhism, for many spiritual paths. But in the early years, growing up in Britain and in the fundamentalist religion of her family, she was drawn to becoming an evangelical worker, as you mentioned. And first she went to Ireland and then was sent to India. That would have been in about the turn of the century, about 1900, where there were many British troops stationed. And she became a kind of... a USO worker, the equivalent, working in a canteen, making hot chocolate, serving scrambled eggs, and preaching the word of the Lord to these British soldiers who were lonely and isolated, and many of them adrift. And she tried to meet their spiritual needs through the gospel. And she had many interesting experiences in India that, as you look back, you can see that was exactly the right beginning for her. It was the beginning of her breaking open her consciousness to the one humanity and the religious, or you should say the spiritual path that doesn't belong to any one particular faith.
Yes, I think that was that experience in India, because it's ironic that... that part of the world became the basis for the teachings that she later wrote in the books that she wrote in the 24 volumes of books she wrote. And those were the Eastern teachings, many of which came from Hinduism. The basis for the teachings are from Hinduism and Buddhism. And she was in that part of the world for quite a number of years.
She... at a certain point after she had been in India for a few years, met a British Army officer with whom she fell in love. And he was not of her class, which was very important to her family. So in order for them to marry, her family decided the young couple would have to be exported from their circumstances and their society, and they were sent to America. For him to attend a seminary, which I suppose would be the Episcopal Church, the Anglican Church. And they started out in Ohio as a young married couple. And that led to her next phase of her life, which was that he was sent with her and their growing family to rural California in the early 1900s, where he became a minister in various parishes in the rural, what I think was the San Joaquin Valley. And it turned out that this man with whom she was so in love was in fact a wife abuser. He was very abusive physically as well as mentally and emotionally. And she describes in kind of harrowing detail life with this man who on the public face was a minister of the Episcopal Church, but on the private face was abusive and frightening. And by this time, they had three young daughters, and it was World War I. They were cut off from their family in Britain. She was in an alien society. People were very kind to her, but they were of another culture, of another class. She was really alone with three little daughters, no money, no ties to her family, and an abusive husband.
And yes, and she eventually they arranged a divorce.
Which was scandalous.
Yeah, because they had to arrange it with the church and, of course, and clear it with the church. And the church gave them the go-ahead and the approval. And so her husband was stationed further away in another parish, and she remained there in Southern California. So this single mom with three kids, three little kids, and no money. So she had to work, go out and find work.
And she started by, I think, raising chickens and selling the eggs and having her own garden. That might be fairly imaginable to us, but for someone of the upper British class and Victorian culture, it was a big shock. And that, I think, was the next stage of her breaking down or breaking apart process. First, her experience in India and her contact with soldiers of so many different backgrounds, as well as with the people of India. Then this experience in California of being destitute.
In fact, she even ended up working in a fish cannery place in Monterey.
Mm-hmm.
And she did the best. She was one of the best sardine packers in the whole factory, I think. And they all came to her to find out how to pack sardines.
She had really no skills. I guess British ladies of her class didn't prepare for an occupation. And so, as she put it, all she really could do was make lovely lace and work in a factory. Mm-hmm. And to support her daughter, she became a canner in a sardine factory. And her story, her autobiography, is so interesting in her description of the people she met. The townspeople in the parishes where her husband was stationed, who all apparently were aware of the abuse that was going on in the home. But in those times, you didn't speak of it publicly or directly. They watched after her, demonstrated enormous kindness and protectiveness toward her and her children, while at the same time not getting involved in something that you can imagine was really untouchable, the local parish priest, guilty of such terrible behavior on the private front. Nobody knew what to do about it. And so her experiences that we're trying to describe are basically one encounter after another that broke down the limitations in her consciousness of separatism, of isolation from the whole of humanity. You can see how she came into contact with one variety after another of human beings that taught her the oneness of humanity and the beauty of human beings, even those who are very different from oneself.
Right. She was thrown into from this very upper aristocratic life in the early life, in the early days, until she was in her early 20s, and then she went off to India and then suddenly plunged into this completely different kind of life in America. It was must have been quite a shock to her, but also a learning experience.
Mm-hmm. A necessary shock.
For those people who just tuned in, you're listening to Inner Sight. Our topic for today, the discipleship of Alice A. Bailey. And we have a special offer from Luce's Publishing Company. And that's the book that we're talking about, The Unfinished Autobiography of Alice Bailey, of course. It's called The Unfinished Autobiography. And although her death in 1949 prevented Alice Bailey from completing this book, enough of her life's story emerges to show the stages in her spiritual journey from Christian evangelism to mastery of the ageless wisdom, author, lecturer, and teacher. It's available today for $15, and the special offer comes in the form of a discount, in the sense that you get free shipping and handling. So what you need to do if you want to take advantage of this offer, that's the book, The Unfinished Autobiography, send a check or money order for $15 to Lucis Publishing. Lucis is L-U-C-I-S, Lucis Publishing, 120 Wall Street, New York, New York, 10005. And also, we want to express our appreciation for your donations. That's what keeps us on the air. It certainly demonstrates your support of us, and we'd appreciate you continuing to send donations. So if you would like to make a donation, send it to Lucis Trust, 120 Wall Street, New York, New York, 10005. And also, if you'd like to contact us for any reason, whether it's books, cassette tapes, or radio shows, or if you'd like a general package of information explaining what Lucis Trust is and how you might become more involved in Lucis Trust, give us a call at 1-866-695-8247. That's a toll-free number, 1-866-695-8247. The easy way to remember it is 1-866-NY-LUCIS. Think of 1-866-NY-LUCIS. Our website, and you can find out so much about Lucis Trust from our website, but many people key into the website to listen to our previously archived library of radio shows. The website, www.lucistrust.org. And I'd like to get back to talking about Alice Bailey. She reached reached that major watershed development in her life, or a dramatic turning point. What was it? Could you comment on that turning point in her life that was so dramatic to her development?
At the age of about 35, which for a lot of people is a very significant year, she reached a real crisis, personal and spiritual. Here she was alone, her husband sent off to a distant town, World War I, sending her no money. She had no contact with her family in Britain, three little girls to care for, no money, working in a sardine factory. She was flat on her face in more ways than one. She was really bereft of any help at all, or so she felt. And her deep Christian faith brought her to the realization that it didn't give her the answer she had always trusted that it would. She came to a blank wall, you could say. And at that point, as is so often the case with spiritual development, at that point of reaching that wall, she was open to something completely new. And that was the breaking apart of her orthodox religious views. Out of sheer desperation, she opened herself, without realizing it, to a new spiritual approach. And very soon after that, in the town where she was living in near Monterey, she was brought into touch with two British ladies of her class and background who lived in the town. And just out of sheer loneliness, she finagled a meeting with them, got herself invited to a tea or whatever. And she realized when she met them that they were involved in the study of something called theosophy. They were reading literature by someone named H.P. Blavatsky. Alice didn't know anything about that philosophy. She just wanted some friendship with people of her class and background. But as she began to become aware of what they were studying, she was really drawn to it. And herself became a deep student of theosophy and the secret doctrine, which is a much different view of spiritual life than Orthodox religion. It draws upon the Eastern doctrines that she was already familiar with from having been in India.
Right, and it was an eye-opener for her because it suddenly expanded her whole awareness of the world and the other religions of the world and other teachings of the world. And it was really an eye-opener, and she became a very avid follower of this theosophical teaching.
And a teacher herself.
And yes, eventually she became a teacher. She became, she was very good at lecturing as a lecturer from her Christian upbringing in early days. And so she lectured on and taught on theosophy using the basis of theosophical teachings.
And it was at this time that she recollected something that had happened to her many years before that she had kind of put out of her mind. This is rather difficult to explain, but it's crucial to understanding her spiritual path. When she was about 15, a young girl in northern, I think in Scotland at the time, because it was summer, she was staying with her grandmother. The whole family had gone off to church, but for some reason that morning Alice hadn't, and she was home alone when suddenly, as she describes it, a man dressed in Eastern garb walked into the sitting room where Alice was and told her that if she could get a grip on herself and stop being such a pain in the neck, they had work for her to do. And that was, in essence, his message. And he left as abruptly as he had come. Well, she was stunned by that. And I think basically kind of put it in the background of her mind for many, many years after that. But she realized as she began to immerse herself in theosophy that this person who had walked in on her that Sunday morning so many years before was in fact one of the spiritual hierarchy or masters. And she met him by recognizing his portrait in one of the rooms in the theosophical headquarters in Southern California, where she was now living, in a place called Crotona in what is now Hollywood, of all things. There was a theosophical society retreat, or whatever you would call it, where she was living, working, teaching, and she realized that she had this connection with a master who had told her there was work for her to do.
And when she blurted out to the people there in the theosophical office that this was her master, they, of course, didn't believe her for a minute and thought that she wasn't really capable of being a disciple. So that was the first lesson for her, to keep her mouth closed about this sort of thing, because it could blow up in your face. And a short time after that, the Theosophical Society went through some crisis of its own, and Alice found herself outside. She
was cast out.
Cast out, right.
She and her husband-to-be, Foster Bailey, whom she met in the Theosophical...
In Crotona.
At that time, they decided to move east to New York, and that was where she began the work that we in the Lucis Trust and the Arcane School carry on to this day. Her life as a disciple, which is one who serves and learns, in essence, was really two pillars that developed out of this crisis that she reached when she was about 35. The one was her intention to establish a school of spiritual development that would train men and women, mature adults, to become of service to the plan of God and to cooperate more actively and intelligently with the spiritual hierarchy, which is the masters, the evolved beings who watch over and guide and prompt human evolution from behind the scenes. They do not manipulate our will. They do not coerce or take charge, but they work mentally with the impression of ideas and recognitions that humanity must register and implement of its own free volition if we are to progress as a species. And Alice's intention to establish the Arcane School was to train people in techniques of meditation and study to become more active cooperators.
And maybe we should say something about how she came in contact with the actual source of these teachings.
Mm-hmm.
It happened while she was working with the Theosophical Society, and one day she was out on the hillside behind her home just relaxing. And suddenly she heard this musical tone coming out of nowhere, apparently. And then she heard a voice say, and this was coming to her very clearly, I have some work, some books I want you to write. Would you do it? Would you do so? And immediately she refused. She said, no, I don't want to be any part of this. And, you know, she thought it was having to do more with psychism and all of that, and she didn't want to be any part of that. But he persisted, and he got back to her. This voice came back to her 3 weeks later and persisted and asked her to at least write one book, work with him for a period of a month or so. And she did, finally. And she started writing, taking down the dictation, which was telepathically received. It was a mind-to-mind contact from this source.
Not disembodied, not
no.
A living person.
This was a living human being. He he was in...
It's not mediumship.
He was, at that time, an abbot in a monastery in on the borders of Tibet in India. And... but he was reaching her telepathically from mind to mind. And so they began an odyssey which lasted for 30 years of writing down these 24 books. And it was all done by telepathic communication.
To me, if that sounds a little bit far-fetched, think about people perhaps 100 or 125 years ago imagining today that we can talk on tiny little phones to each other. It's another form of communication that nobody probably would have envisioned as possible 130, 40 years ago. And this telepathic contact, I think, will become more common and more understandable as we progress in our spiritual evolution. But the point is not whether you believe that contact is possible or not. The point is the content of the book she wrote. And there's a wonderful statement by Thomas A. Kempis in his book The Imitation of Christ, which addresses this question. He said, "Ask not who said this, but mark what is said. Men pass away, but the truth of the Lord remains forever. Judge something on its truth and on your response or lack of response to it. Use your own intuition."
Please take advantage of the special offer from Lucis Publishing Company, and that's the book that we're talking about today. Ask for The Unfinished Autobiography, and it really takes you very nicely through the spiritual journey of Alice Bailey from Christian evangelism to mastery of the ageless wisdom and so much more about her interesting life. It's available for $15. There's a discount in the form of free shipping and handling. Send your check or money order to Lucis Publishing, 120 Wall Street, New York, New York, 10005. You've been listening to Inner Sight. Now we would like to close with a world prayer called the Great Invocation. It's a call for light and love and goodwill to flow into the world and into our hearts. Let's listen for a moment to these powerful words.
From the point of light within the mind of God, let light stream forth into human minds. Let light descend on earth. From the point of love within the heart of God, let love stream forth into human hearts. May the coming one return to earth. From the center where the will of God is known, let purpose guide all little human wills, the purpose which the masters know and serve. From the center which we call the human race, let the plan of love and light work out, and may it seal the door where evil dwells. Let light and love and power restore the plan on earth.